So good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us. We are very excited to be here with you today to talk about cell and gene therapy supply strategies. I am here today with our Director of Clinical Supply Chain for North America, Ed Grollo, who used to work at Eli Lilly before we were able to steal him away. And he now heads up our SMART team. Our SMART team helps small and medium-sized companies with clinical supply management services. So if you need an additional resource to look at your distribution, your clinical supply management, our SMART team can help you with that. We also have a very, very special guest, someone who has cracked me up through the numerous prep calls that we've had. Scott Onision, our Senior VP of Commercial Operations and Clinical Trial Logistics from QuickStat, who from the very first prep call, I just found to be an absolute wealth of information regarding cell and gene therapy supply strategy. So thank you for being here with us, Scott. Really
Thanks,
appreciate it.
Not blushing.
But we can't tell over video, so you're good. If you do have questions throughout this chat, so remember that this is our virtual water cooler chat. The idea is that we're just hanging out around the water cooler. If you have any questions, please find your way to the toolbar in Teams, and there is a chat icon. Just click on that and type in any questions you may have about cell and gene therapy. For those of you who that function is not working for, you can always text, iMessage, or WhatsApp me at country code 1-619-613-0808. With that, Ed, I'd like to turn it over to you to lead us through cell and gene therapy supply strategies.
Sure, thanks. Hi, welcome everybody. And I'm Ed Grollo, and I'm here to kick off the conversation because cell and gene therapy has kind of become a little passion for me. This seems like it's really new technology. It's actually was started back in the 70s. It went through about 50 years of ups and downs with some research steadily climbing, but a few setbacks along the way. But we finally reached the point where we're getting our first true medicines approved in cell and gene therapy. And I've just gotten so passionate about it because the power, the potential capabilities of cell and gene therapy are absolutely amazing, and they are revolutionizing the pharmaceutical industry. One thing we've been talking about with Scott and I is just how the future of cell and gene therapy and the future of medicines are pointing this direction. For those of you who are currently working in cell and gene therapy, you already understand how unbelievably exciting the science is. For people who aren't directly working in it right now, this is truly the frontiers of science in the pharmaceutical industry. Most medicines will treat a condition by alleviating the symptoms until the body can cure itself, or they're replacing some therapy that the body is no longer able to do, and then the patient's on a lifetime of medicine. And what we're looking at with cell and gene therapy is the possibility, the potential for a single treatment to fix a person's DNA so they no longer have hemophilia or cystic fibrosis or some genetic disease. This is truly the frontiers of science, and it's just amazing. But despite it having 50 years of research, this is still very much a fledgling industry. There's still a lot more issues and unknowns than there are knowns. And I could go on a long time about all of the different aspects of the science and craziness behind it, but we're here to focus on what's required for supporting clinical trials in cell and gene therapy. So I'm going to throw out just a couple of the issues or nuances that are unique to cell and gene, and then we'll take it over from there. The process starts, as many of you will know, with some cell collections, and then they have to be purified and isolated and tested. Then the materials, the components, what would be analogous to the starting materials, like the gene editing component, the viral vector, the RNA or DNA that's going to get introduced to the cells, they all have to be manufactured under sterile conditions. And then all of those things get brought together in one location where they're modified and packaged and stored until they're needed at the site. So this is, and throughout all of that process, there's extensive testing that gets done through everything. The issue is that all of this is new technology. These are small mom and pop shops scattered all over the world. So there could easily be a dozen companies in a dozen different countries involved in this crazy supply chain that starts under GCP conditions with the collection of those cells controlling it. Then it moves to GMP regulations for the manufacturer and then circles back to GCP again for the dosing. So prior to working with Cell and Gene, I could not have imagined a more complex, convoluted supply chain in my life. And then the second aspect of that is the timing that's involved. So these things start off with the donor cell collection that has a limited amount of time. It needs to get to that site where it's purified, and that's usually measured in hours. And at the other end of the spectrum is this insanely expensive and potentially irreplaceable drug product that also has to get delivered to the clinical site within a finite amount of range for dosing. And so aside from being incredibly complex, these supply chains also require meticulous coordination and timing in order to be successful. So the entire process is from start to finish is just unbelievably timed, and you need to have good partners like PCI, where you have a sense of ownership and exceptional communications and robust processes that can be function under multiple quality systems. So it's just a crazy expensive process. So I could talk a long time longer about all of this stuff and ramble on about it, but I just wanted to throw out those couple of things. Please be sure to open that it's show conversations window and use the chat function to throw out comments and ask questions yourself. And now I'm going to turn this over to Scott, who's going to talk about other aspects of the crazy supply chain.
Ed, thanks so much. And everyone, as Ed said, please send in questions, because if we were around the coffee machine or the water cooler at work, if we were doing a monologue, we'd lose a lot of you pretty quickly. So please throw out some questions, and we're more than happy to answer them if we can, and we'll do our best to answer them. So, and I couldn't have said it better myself. I thought you did a fantastic job of explaining that. And to me, if we're talking about cell and gene therapy, it's, you know, you probably heard about CAR T therapies, and you heard about neoantigen therapies, CRISPR technology, all of those things. We're not going to do a deep dive into the science today, but I think what's really important for everybody to understand is that there's autologous therapies and allogeneic therapies. And the reason why it's important to understand is because with an autologous therapy, it's very simple. Just think one-to-one. It's going to be a circular supply chain. You're going to start with the patient and you're going to end with the patient. So as Ed mentioned, you have GCP, GMP, and GCP again, but in between that you have GDP, good distribution practices. And that's where a company like Quickstat or other specialist logistics companies are going to come in. And with an allogeneic therapy, you're coming from one to many. So the nice thing is if you have experience in high value biologics already, a lot of the supply chain lessons that you learn from high value biologics can be pulled in to an allogeneic supply chain. Things that might be different, time and temperature. I know many allogeneic therapies where once the therapy is constituted, they have 48 hours or 72 hours to dose a patient. That can be easy within the EU or easy within domestic US, but let's say you don't want to spend the money to do the tech transfer to manufacture in Asia or manufacture in the US, you're going to do everything in Europe. It might be a challenge to get to some sites in secondary cities. So you need to think about that from a supply chain. Where's your manufacturing facility? Where are the sites that you want to go to? You also need to think about regulations. And so that's something that I'm hoping that people have questions about today. What regulations should you consider when you're needing to do export and import into a country? How does that affect where you choose to store your therapies? And then you're going to want to think about things like chain of identity, chain of security, chain of custody, because all those things are extremely important. Think about it, an autologous therapy, it's one-to-one. That patient can't get somebody else's therapy. And as Ed mentioned, many of the patients being treated within this space right now are actually very sick. A lot of these therapies are designed to treat cancer and some other high-risk diseases. So something to think about is that. And then the last thing I'd say we want to think about, or the last two things, would be communication with stakeholders. You have CROs, you have CMOs, you have sites, you have doctors, and you have patients that are at the end of this. And they very much are affected by what it is we're doing. And you also on the supply chain side will have the LN2 providers, the logistics providers, the GPS providers, and all that hardware. So you need to make sure that that's being managed correctly. And it needs to be done in a way to scale up. Because if you think about an autologous supply chain, whatever you do at the clinical level, you're going to scale up. So when you go from dozens of sites and hundreds of patients to hundreds of sites and thousands of patients, you need to scale. So those are the topics I'm hoping that we discuss today. And if there's any questions that anybody wants to ask, feel free. Otherwise, we can start, you know, going through some of the talking points and kind of explain some of the things we see around those areas. But we'd much rather have some involvement from the audience and answer any questions that you might have on this.
Have you gotten anything, Marissa? In yet? Okay. So I guess while we're waiting for people to come up, so one of the things I think, Scott, we can ask about or look at is something a little timely. So what have you seen from COVID's impact on distribution and impact in cell and gene?
It's a great question. I mean, everybody, you know, that's why we're doing these remote learnings. So COVID-19, as you can imagine, for a logistics company, it's been a challenge. If you think about how most of these therapies are transported, Ed, they're going on passenger aircraft. If you look at the worldwide fleet of passenger aircraft, it's running at, I think, 80 to 90% of planes are grounded right now. The reason why you're generally using passenger aircraft for these types of therapies is because of time sensitivity and because it's a very high value and also high impact therapy that you're shipping. So it might not only cost a lot to make, it might be the only shot that patient has at receiving treatment, because they might be that far along in their illness that they can't wait to get another treatment made. And so with that many flights down, we're having to look at alternatives. The nice thing within the cell and gene therapy space is you need to invest time up front already. So there was huge amounts of risk mitigation already planned. There was secondary, tertiary routing. And in some cases, there's the fourth or fifth option for routing that we've already looked at for these locations. We've also had extensive discussions with the sponsors. A lot of the therapies right now, we were actually, for the clinical stage, we're actually looking to use charters. So when really aircrafts were pretty much almost shut down between the US and Europe, charter aircrafts were being used, which wasn't unprecedented. We've used them in the past, but it was absolutely the first method they wanted to go with because they didn't want to trust that a flight would take off that day and they couldn't wait for it to do so. So that was a huge impact there. Around Europe, we've seen a lot of direct drives. It was interesting when Poland closed its borders, we saw direct drives where we'd actually transfer the therapy at the border to another driver. There had to be pictures taken, sign-offs. There's chain of custody involved, making sure that nothing's tampered with. And then it goes on to the next person in that supply chain. So there's all sorts of backup plans that we've used. The great thing is once you had a lot of that planning already in place, it was easy to manage some of the lanes. And then where some of the things were unprecedented, like I mentioned with the Polish border shutting down or other items happening, we were able to find solutions pretty quickly. And that's through really good communication with the sponsors and with partners like PCI to make sure the supply chain doesn't stop.
Matt Sargent's got a question here, a comment, wanting to talk about success stories and how we've managed some challenges, major challenges, how they were overcome due to the complexity of the supply chain and the need to assure that the chain of custody of the product. Do you find a separate IT system such as cell orchestration platform is needed, or can this be managed appropriately using all existing technologies like IRTs? That's great question, Matt. And things I've seen are, again, with this fledgling industry, there's a lot of things playing catch up on the technology side and the regulatory side and all of that. I'm not familiar with the COP, but I've seen IRTs try to be adapted to manage inventory or to track inventory and keep tabs on things. From the autologous side, it's almost unnecessary because you're going one-to-one so that the cells get collected from that patient, they get modified and put right back in that patient. So there isn't aren't as many requirements along that. But from the allogeneic side, it's more complex because not only are you tracking the individual vials that are given to a patient, because you do have an inventory of drug that's much more similar to a traditional pharmaceutical, but in addition to keeping tabs on, you know, what exact vial went to a patient, there's also a big need and desire as part of the research to know what donor that came from. So you're going to be collecting cells from multiple donors and trying to make sure you have donor variability across is one of the factors, really, is almost a stratification factor with the dispensing and randomization. So that's one of the technological difficulties that still need to be overcome. And I think IRT vendors can still work on that and work on those things. In addition, I think another success factor I've seen is on the regulatory side. There are a lot of regulatory aspects that just weren't taken into account. The 536214 2014 that's coming out in Europe, if you look at that one and the requirement to put the expiry date on every container, that was came out in 2014. So, which means it was written in 2011, maybe they were talking about doing that. So what was the status of cell and gene therapy at that time? It was not on anybody's radar really at where we're at now. So this requirement to put expiry dates on vials that need to be kept at liquid nitrogen temperature and then update that date, you're risking the material. I think those types of topics need to be brought up with regulatory agencies. And where I've seen it successfully used right now is that vials are labeled with a single panel, single language label that might have a date of manufacture on there. And then when it comes time to update the expiry, the carton that's in is discarded and a new carton put on that has the actual expiry date on there and the date of manufacture stays on the vial. And the drug then isn't as risked for any stability issues. So that's one thing I think I've seen that's successful.
And just to add, I think, Ed, so to Matthew, to your question about cell orchestration platform. So having been doing this for quite a long time. So my experience at our organization, we actually helped support the first two ever FDA approved CAR T therapies. And when those therapies first kind of went into the clinic, a lot of these cell orchestration platforms didn't exist, right? And so the IRT systems that were already available, QuickStats, actually Quick Online system was used for the logistics piece because it's just focused on logistics. Other IRT systems were used. In one case, one of those companies actually created their own platform in which to manage this. And then out of this, as we've seen a proliferation of cell and gene therapies come out, you see companies like Vinetti, companies like TrackCell, companies like Be The Match, Ernst & Young is coming out with their own platform, Deloitte. I'm not here to promote anybody's platform. What I've seen is a lot of organizations in the early stages can get away with using the normal IT systems that they use early on in phase one and phase 2A. As you start scaling up to phase 2B or to a phase 3, and you're starting, especially for an autologous where you're thinking about commercialization, that's where I think those platforms, those software systems are going to be valuable because they can do a lot more managing your CMO, managing your couriers network, and putting everything into one place. And one thing to mention is, look, the pioneer days are kind of coming to an end, I hope, within this space. And a lot of companies are pushing for consistency. And that's going to be extremely critical for all stakeholders across these supply chains, and especially at the site. Imagine if you're a site and you have to log into pharma company A's system, and then the vendor for pharma company B. It's going to be challenging, especially as you see more and more of these trials come out, to have 10 or 15 systems log into. It's not sustainable. So I think there's going to be need to be consistency there. And that's a call to action, as Steve Jacobs likes to say a lot. That's really a call to action for the industry. And I know at the Global Clinical Supply Group, there's a lot of sponsors getting together to help shape that message. I think to answer Bev's question about major challenges that have been overcome, I think it's always best to use a story, an anecdote, right? And so there's one example that I could think of. And there was a company, and this is Allogeneic. And I like to use this one because with autologous, it's definitely a special case, and there's plenty I can mention there as well. but it was an allogeneic therapy. A large pharma company had acquired another company that had this technology, so they weren't used to these type of therapies. The manufacture of that therapy took place within a specific country in the EU. That country in the EU, there's two countries in the EU that have special regulations around biologics. So you can probably guess one of the two countries. That's where the country's manufacturer, that's where the therapy's manufacturer was going to take place. That worked well because the initial phases of the trial were all European Union based. So there was no export from the European Union. The company that did the acquiring was a Japanese based company. They wanted to have sites in Japan be part of that trial. They did not want to pay the millions of dollars to do a tech transfer to have to manufacture in Asia. Plus, they hadn't been able to identify a manufacturing facility in Asia that they wanted to use. Again, as we start moving away from the pioneer stages and we're seeing more manufacturing come up in that region, those things might change, but it could also be cost-driven. Long story short, we ended up working with that pharma company to go to the Ministry of Health in that country where the manufacturer is happening to have a discussion. They originally told us that we'd have to follow the export guidelines. By following the export guidelines they had for biologics, it was going to cause any collection we did that day to be delayed export to the next day. That therapy, once constituted, had to be dosed to the patient within 48 hours. That was never going to work. So we had to sit back down with the Ministry of Health again and explain to them, look, we really, here's why we don't think this these regulations apply. We think the science has gone beyond the regulations. And by the way, if this doesn't change, we are going to move the manufacturer to another European Union country. That got their ears up. We were able to get a special dispensation so that we still had to do an export process, but it avoided the day delay. And then on the Japanese end, there was something called the Yakinshome, which is the import permit. Long story short, we had a similar conversation there. They understood the need to be able to help patients get this therapy for their clinical trial. They gave a special exemption for the trial so that the Yakinshome could either be done wheels up or within 5 hours of entering the country. We were able to dose the patients in Tokyo quite effectively. And then we actually used onboard courier for the final mile from Tokyo to other locations within Japan. We actually used the Shinkansen, the speed train, to do the final mile. And that was able to accommodate them. They were able to dose all the patients they wanted to at the sites they wanted to. But you know, that would never have happened without those initial investments and discussions up front. So hopefully, Bev, that kind of shows an example of how you can overcome the time element.
All right. Sue's asking about how do you manage temperature conditions when storing and transporting products that require minus 80 or minus 150 C. And that's where technology has really improved quite a bit. And there's really three different aspects of that you're looking at. You know, you've got the technology behind the actual containers that are used, and then the courier that's involved that we'll let Scott talk about. And then the third one is the big improvements that have come out in the track and trace and monitoring, where you've got the ability to have now equipment that's integrated with cell towers and geo positioning, so you know exactly where your material's at any one time and what conditions it's under, so you can, unlike the traditional, you know, original ways where, well, you've got a monitoring device with the package, and when it gets there, you keep your fingers crossed and hope it was made it there the whole way. And now there's a lot better technology in that. So I'll let Scott take over and talk a lot about that.
It's a great question. I mean, if you look at a Vexis, right, they're acquired by Novartis. You look at their therapy, I think it's being sold for $2.1 million as a gene therapy. So if you think about having to maintain that temperature in transit, I mean, it's critical, but with that price point, it's even more critical. So it's going to be interesting to see what solutions you'll use to do that. So Sue, to your question, when you're talking about minus 80, that's generally where we're seeing gene therapies. So a lot of the gene therapies are being shipped on dry ice. Dry ice has been around forever, so it's a very easy temperature to maintain. One thing that I'll say, though, that we need to think about, and I literally had this conversation with a gene therapy company yesterday, is that as these therapies proliferate, you're going to have more companies that are needing to send these gene therapies on dry ice all over the world. If you just look at the domestic U.S. network, domestic U.S. flights, a lot of flights limit the amount of dry ice that can go on the flight and limit the amount of dry ice to a package. So that could actually have a severe impact, because let's say in the cargo hold, you have a pet or an animal that needs to fly on that passenger flight, your shipment could be bumped. So a lot of people are using dry ice packaging. They're using GPS, like Ed said, to monitor that shipment in transit so we can locate it. It can be re-iced in transit all over the world. There's definitely networks that have been set up. A lot of it was due to central lab supply chains. But I think it's a call to action for us to, from a science standpoint, if the gene therapy is able to be shipped at minus 40 or minus 20, then there's other phase change material that you could use. And that might add some complexity to get the conditioning done, but it should eliminate some of the risk in doing the transport. So that's just something to think about from a science standpoint. On the minus 150, that's where you're going to be in minus 150 and below to minus 196 Celsius. That's where you're going to see the use of liquid nitrogen dry shippers. Again, we've seen a big proliferation of the use of those dry shippers, where the airlines are getting more used to handling them. At the same time, what you need to think about is the liquid nitrogen dry shippers, and not to get too much in the weeds, but I think it's extremely important. To use a liquid nitrogen, that's the charge material that holds the temperature. The orientation of the door that holds the liquid nitrogen, the more you tilt the door, the faster the vaporization rate. Essentially, all that means is the hold time of the unit is actually affected by the orientation of the unit. Some of these units are too tall to be put in upright into a narrow-bodied aircraft. Think about inter-European Union flights or U.S. flights. Most flights, unless you're traveling from East Coast to the West Coast or a longer distance or on a major hub, it's not going to have a wide-body aircraft. So you need to think about what type of unit you're using. If it's on its side, it's no matter what unit it is, it's still going to have a decrease in hold time. Is the hold time still going to be long enough to maintain that temperature? You're definitely going to want to have a GPS in that unit. You're definitely going to want to have real-time temperature. You're definitely going to want to have geolocation so you can pump out data. But that's really where you need to invest with your partners to understand the supply chain, where you're going to ship to and from, which LN2s you're going to use. Because to me, those are commodities. What's the better mousetrap? And I think that's where partners like PCI and QuickStack can help you, you know, kind of navigate any sort of questions you have there.
All right, we are rapidly approaching our time here. I think we got one more question from George on, do you have case studies performed that can be shared that show end-to-end processes? Ooh, and it just moved off my screen. especially from a commercial perspective, have you seen how the shipping studies have been performed for gene therapies and the serialization in scope for gene therapy? So the commercialization is kind of a curious one because last year was the first true cell and gene therapy product that was approved. So there aren't a whole lot of case studies where, you know, this industry is in its infancy and we're, you know, the gates are starting to open, but we're going to be seeing a lot more of it, I'm sure. For serialization, I can take that part that, yes, it is used for the allogeneic portion because it's actually very useful because you do want to track which vial went to which patient very closely for not only treatment factors and when they're doing, you know, dose ranging studies and all the other aspects of initial trials, but also to keep track of which donor went to which person and the aspects of the individual donor that are still unknowns, a big part of that, which is a whole other topic to get into. For shipping studies, Scott, are there any special shipping studies that get done?
Sure. So, well, I think if you talk about, shipping studies, absolutely. You're going to do validations, test runs. I mean, I absolutely push my clients to do that. You could probably tie in George's questions with Nicole's question, because if you think about, you know, how you're classifying the products as well, that's going to come into the case studies we see. What we see from a standpoint of classification, we have some companies that are classifying the cell therapies as a GMO. We have some companies when they're classifying the apheresis or leukapheresis or tissue sample, whatever the starter material is, some of the companies will classify it as an API, like you would an active pharmaceutical ingredient, and they'll value it that way. So that will have an effect of how you move therapies. What I can tell you is, like, a lot of people think about, you know, oh, well, Brazil is going to be a challenge because I know we're doing some commercialization in Brazil. And it absolutely is. Brazil is probably one of the more challenging countries to import into. But what I will tell you is the U.S., if you're not manufacturing in the U.S. and you're manufacturing in Europe and you're bringing a therapy like this into the U.S., the FDA at every port of entry is going to, they can treat the guidelines differently. And so what we've recommended is to have engagement at the FDA level in each port to ensure that your therapy is going to be able to go through and not be delayed in transit. And in regards to case study, what we'll try to do is we're going to do a white paper, I believe, after this, and we'll include a case study in there, George, because I know QuickStat, like I said before, they've helped support two of the first FDA approved therapies into commercialization. So we can definitely take one of those examples and try to do a case study, you know, on some of the things we've seen. And one other thing to mention, and I'm going to borrow from Tim Moore, who used to be at Kite. One of the things that he said on a panel was one of the biggest challenges they had when they went from clinical to commercialization was everything they had done originally when they did the clinical trial of engaging and educating the sites on how come the supply chain was important for an autologous therapy. They needed to redo that when they went to commercialization with the new sites and the existing sites. Because with an autologous therapy, it's vein to vein. Every delay you have up front is going to have a domino effect with your CMO, with your cryopreservation site, with the actual therapy getting back to the patient again. So that was really interesting to me, as he said, you got to start at the site level and educate. And if you can do that, that's going to have a huge impact across your entire supply chain.
This is it. Yeah. Been great. It's gone quick. Fabulous question, Brooke. I'll try and put some information in that in the paper that follows up. But I think we're out of time, Marissa, if you wanted to wrap up.
Ed, I do think it's important to answer Brooke's question. So if you or Scott have like two minutes to answer Brooke's questions, that would be great.
Sure. Yeah, I've got time for that. Sure. The question was, you mentioned several couriers. What do you believe is the best practice to validate them and so the secure chain of custody with allogeneic therapies? The product moves through so many couriers. How do you control and monitor consistency? So yeah, from my aspect, one recommendation I have is when you're evaluating the entire supply chain, and this is where a big evaluation needs to happen from the very beginning to the very end, you know, when you're looking at all of the components and aspects going in there, there's a lot of work that goes into ensuring the robustness of that chain, that you understand what it is, that it's well worked out in all of the shipping lanes, and it's moving from so many places, you know, all those components are coming together. One thing I stress is make sure you've worked out who your importer of record is. I've seen so many issues come up with that because the, you know, these small companies that are doing this, you know, these aren't major pharma companies that have, you know, presences in all of the countries around the world. They don't have all these affiliates. You know, you got a company of a couple hundred people maybe that's located in one place. And so you need to really work out who's going to be your IOR and who can be your IOR, where you're going to be moving that material around to. So very much look into that. And that's my recommendation. Scott?
Just to add to that, I think when you think about, you know, validating your supply chain and validating the couriers you're going to use, I think it's extremely important you understand the quality systems they're adhering to. You understand the IT platforms you're going to have access to. Communication is going to be critical. All these stakeholders involved, whether it's the CMO or the site, are going to need. What I would found is that you don't want to have too many chefs in the kitchen. What I mean by that is identify who needs to know when or what when. So when should the site be kept up to date? When should the CMO be kept up to date so that they're not getting noise and the information they get is actually actionable and useful for them? So that's really critical. I would meet weekly and monthly once things start getting on track with your supply chain couriers to make sure what the KPIs they're meeting, how are they performing? In times of COVID right now, we're meeting more frequently with our clients whose cell and gene therapies we're supporting because it's more of a challenge to move their shipments than it was in the past because of the way, you know, there's less cargo space on passenger airplanes, all of those things. So what I would say is consistency of feedback, consistency of reviewing KPIs, making sure you're going through those. Upfront investment of planning. So risk assessments on routes, having backup, secondary, tertiary, you know, backup plans for all those routes that you're looking at, have agreed upon backup plans that you can use. So in this situation, if this happens, we're already approved to do Y. So the example I'm going to give is real quick, just the charter aircraft. If you have to, we have to get your CEO's approval to use a charter aircraft on a Sunday, we might not get that. If we already know we have that approval in advance, we don't compromise that shipment. So that's important. And the last thing I say is, look, there's a lot of great competition within the specialist courier environment. I think if you're trying to take a cell or gene therapy to commercialization, I would absolutely look to have a primary and a secondary option because it's really, you know, on the sponsor companies to ensure that they have contingencies. And I think that's important. And I think there's plenty of work to go around within their space. There's plenty of good competitors in this space, and competition forces all your providers, including logistics providers, to do better and to be better.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Scott and Ed. And for those of you who stuck around, I hope you got all your questions answered. If you do have additional cell and gene therapy questions, feel free to continue putting this into the chat even after we sign off, and we can definitely make sure to answer those in our white paper when we come out with that. Other than that, I would like to quickly just ask you to turn your attention to the screen. We do have a few more water cooler chats coming up next week on Thursday. If you are a small company, you will definitely want to tune in to listen to Mark Szczepanski talk about clinical supply solutions for small companies. Mark has helped small companies with clinical supply solutions for over 10 years now, so that will be a great talk. So I saw some questions here about HTS codes, clinical material valuations. We will be focusing on that in from a US perspective and from an EU perspective on June 25th and July 9th, respectively. You can register for these at pciservices.com/water. And for those of you who have stuck with me until now, heads up that we will be promoting a few new chats next Thursday. So definitely keep an eye out for that email coming through. Thank you, everyone, and have a wonderful day. See you at the next Water Cooler chat.
Hi, everybody. Bye. Thank you.